Welcome to Technogram, the Ringtons podcast, where we highlight inspiring and untold stories from the tech world. Today, we are thrilled to have Rick Ferguson, who is the Vice President for Security Intelligence at Forescout. Rick's journey in the cybersecurity world has been nothing short of remarkable. He has spent, I think, more than over two decades helping businesses, individuals, governments understand the complexities of technology and its intersection with cybercrime. He has been a trusted advisor to law enforcement agencies globally, thanks to his deep understanding of the murky world of cyber threats and the bright future of technology. So let's dive into Rick's story and understand how digital transformation can help bridge the digital divide with cybersecurity measures at its heart. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. I know you have flown in and it's been a few hectic hours for you.
It's a whirlwind. I'm literally in and out in 24 hours.
So. Wow. This must be a regular thing for you, right?
Yeah, I was complaining at the hotel when I checked in. It's like this, the joy of business travel is you get to travel all over the world and see nothing.
All right. So when we were talking earlier, we were just discussing and you were saying that back 30 years ago when you had started your career, cybersecurity never existed. So that's right. I think cybersecurity was coined maybe in the late 80s. So how did that pan out? How did your journey pan out? How did you find your interest in cybersecurity?
So I had always had, it depends how far back you want to go, but I'd always had an interest in technology in general. I'm 54 now, so I'm of the generation when personal computers at home were first beginning to become something that was accessible to regular families, you know, just standard income families. When Sinclair introduced the ZX80, the ZX81, the Spectrum, when there was the VIC-20, Commodore 64, all of those things that really was this first explosion of computers in the home. They were never a home device. So I had my ZX Spectrum and I was subscribing to a monthly magazine called Your Computer. Mm-hmm. And the center spread in this magazine was code.
Okay.
Like, and you would spend hours typing on the spongy keyboard of the ZX Spectrum, the basic code from pages and pages to run your own game. And it was, you know, it was sparked an interest and was also the beginning of a lot of understanding because you were literally code deep. There wasn't a graphical user interface. There wasn't a GUI on these things. It was a text-based user interface. At school, we had computer studies with BBC Model B computers. Again, text interface.
Yeah.
My professional journey, I actually did a degree in French.
Okay.
So my degree had nothing to do with technology. It was just something that I was interested in. But my professional journey really started in 1994. So this year is my 30th year in technology.
Wow, three decades. That's amazing.
Yeah. And it started because I spoke two languages, English and French, and quote unquote knew a bit about computers. That was kind of my qualification at the time. And I was working in technical support. And it was the perfect crucible for learning. I did eventually, I think, 12 years in tech support, which is a really long time. And it just means that every day you're the person at the end of the phone, you pick up the phone and you're dealing immediately with something that's broken and someone that's angry.
Yes.
Hi, Rick speaking, how can I help you?
Yes.
And it's up to you to get that business back up and running again. Mm. Back then, it was an incredibly mixed, heterogeneous environment. TCP/IP was still a choice. We were talking to customers who were running TCP/IP, who were running IPX, SPX, Novell Network Protocols, people who were running DECLATs, Banyan Vines. There was a whole choice of network protocols. Equally, there was a whole choice even of things you think are now so standard, like network cables.
Yeah.
It wasn't just RJ45 Ethernet. There was 10Base2, there was 10Base5, there was Token Ring. And whoever was calling you could have any mix of any of those things in their environment. And we had to kind of be able to emulate it, find out why something wasn't working, find out what we had to do to get it working, talk to product management, because I worked for a vendor to get that thing fixed so it didn't happen again for other customers. And I did it for a very long time, and it was an incredible learning journey. So I remember when NT4 was released, I remember when Novell 4 was released, and I've seen that development of technology and equally the development of cybercrime as well, from something that was based on mischief and causing harm and doing something for the kicks or doing something to see how far it could go, to something that became actually a criminal enterprise and even an organized criminal enterprise.
Do you remember a point in time when you were like, okay, this could be really something that could blow up in the world, right?
Yeah, late 90s, sort of 98, 9, very end of the 90s is when you started to see particularly one group called the Russian Business Network, RBN, really began to see the potential of what had been happening with things like Slammer, Blaster, Melissa, Nimda, Code Red, all of those worms that caused an awful lot of trouble, but were not designed to make money. It wasn't a criminal enterprise. It was a troublemaking enterprise. But Russian Business Network were definitely among the first that said, there's the potential here to make money, and began the industrialization of cybercrime and the monetization of cybercrime.
Right. Okay. And this is one thing that I thought, like, I want to avoid it, but I don't think we can, because everyone's talking about it. And it's, even if it's not mainstream yet, it's getting there. So AI, IoT, all these emerging technologies, right? What are your views on how does it impact cybersecurity? And how do you think the future will be with these technologies becoming more and more mainstream?
Yeah, it's twofold, isn't it? You have to consider it from the threat actor position, and you have to consider it from the security practitioner defender position. So if we think about threat actor, first of all, you see a lot of things in the media about, you know, criminals using AI and the threat from AI to our businesses and so on. Are they using AI right now? Not really. Will they be using AI in the future? Almost certainly. Mm-hmm. Will they be using it initially in the ways that we think? Probably not. So, and I'll explain that a little bit. So we're not seeing autonomous, artificially intelligent code, malware that will go off, discover a vulnerability, break into a system, laterally move, colonize, steal data independently. That we're not at that stage, anywhere near it. We're not really seeing AI being used autonomously to write code.
Okay.
Humans are still better at that than AI. Certainly, I would be amazed if threat actors are not using AI as a co-pilot to help them write code or to help them port code from one language to another. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's happening. Very much back-end stuff. Where I think we'll see criminals using AI first is more in the campaign management side of things and the data management side of things. For example, you think about how criminals use email. It's still kind of the number one route into a business. Yeah. Most attacks will begin with a phishing email, for example, email of one kind or another, delivering malware, delivering a malicious link, or delivering phishing-based content. Forever, I mean, those criminals have learned from marketing organizations in regular commercial companies. Those emails, for example, will have a campaign marker in the email, so the criminal can track which emails are more effective, which ones get a better click-through, a better response rate, are more convincing, and then they can refine and retarget based on that kind of data. Of course, AI is incredibly helpful for doing that. So we'll see more rapidly evolving, better targeted, more credible attacks as a result of AI being used at the back end of criminal operations.
Okay, because that's interesting, because when we were discussing about you a little bit earlier, my colleague Aditya, he's the one who reached out to you, and he was talking about how he had seen videos about you explaining what happens behind the scenes with the cyber criminals, right?
Yeah.
And you have kind of explained how they go about it. It's mostly has been emails. And this is a video that was released or published more than 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
So have things, I know things have changed, it's evolved for sure, but it's the same methodologies, is the modus operandi the same? And are we making the same mistakes?
So attackers don't change unless we force them to. And by and large, unless it's a particularly targeted attack, by and large, we'll go after the most low-hanging fruit.
Right.
The easiest compromise.
Which happens to be emails for now.
Certainly email, it's one of the services within an organization that will always be internet facing by definition. Of course, we can apply technologies to email to minimize the amount of malicious stuff that gets through, but you have to work on the assumption that something will always get through, because even if you lock down your email, let's say your inbound email, to the extent that only accounts from your, like verified accounts from your business partner, whatever technology you would deploy to make this happen, can come through, well, then the attacker just has to compromise your business partner, and then they send. There's always a route in, right? So you have to assume that that will always happen. So that is a service that's always externally open, externally facing. So of course it's continuously targeted. It's something I think from a recipient perspective, most of us, I'm sure you suffer from volume of email in your inbox. Most people like
yes, we do.
The blue number of unreads constantly going up. So there's always a certain pressure associated with email as well. And I think we don't give it the level of attention that we should. Mm-hmm. And of course, the truth is messaging in one form or another, whether it's email, SMS type technologies, WhatsApp, Signal, so on, whatever it might be, Facebook messaging, anyone's a potential victim. And when I got caught out, I thought it was really important to speak publicly about, hey, I just clicked a link and okay. I gave my password away. I've been doing this for 30 years. It can happen to anyone.
Right.
It was a combination of circumstances that just happened to make the SMS that I received credible. I live in Poland, mm-hmm. right? We had noticed on our bank statement, like, what is this? There's this thing that goes out every month. What is that? I don't recognize it. I don't know where it's going. So we were like, okay, we couldn't find out. So we called the bank and said, we don't know what this is. You need to cancel that charge. 2 days later, I get an SMS in Polish, which is unusual for a malicious SMS anyway, mm-hmm. from Netflix saying, hey, we tried to charge you and the payment didn't go through. So of course my brain immediately went, that must be the thing that we canceled. How silly. So I clicked the link, username, password, and then went, oh, what have I just done? Like, I didn't go any further.
Right.
As soon as I typed the password in, it was like, oh. Luckily, I have a different password for every single web service that I use. So okay. I know that I didn't give away the password for anything else.
Except
I could immediately go into my Netflix account, change the password and fix the situation. But the lesson to me was, it's why I immediately posted about it on LinkedIn at the time. If I can fall for this, anyone can fall for this. And that's why attackers continue to do that. Of course, tools, techniques, procedures, tactics, all of those things continue to evolve and change over time. Ransomware is a great example right now. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the attacker is not, in that first instance, attacking a system. They're attacking a person.
Right.
Later on, they'll be targeting systems to find data of interest, systems of interest, and move laterally within a network. But to get that access, particularly when it comes to messaging-based attacks like phishing, you're attacking a person.
Right. And that's the first way in. And then it goes beyond that.
Yeah. I mean, there are other ways in, like exploiting a vulnerability on external facing infrastructure, like a web server or a file server,
a mail
server,
sure.
whatever it might be. But when it's a messaging based attack, mm-hmm. the mentality and the MO of the attacker is to think about the person they're targeting. It's not a system, it's a person.
And what about things like deepfake? We see a lot of that on social media as well, how it can potentially be something that will change the way we do things.
Yeah, there's great scope for the application of AI in disinformation attacks mm-hmm. in the future. Deepfake is one aspect of that. Obviously, there's voice cloning, there's deepfake, there's image generation, there's fake news generation.
Yeah.
The three countries right now that are most responsible for disinformation activities globally is Russia, China, and Iran. They're the most active in creating global disinformation campaigns, using social networks to amplify them. There is some evidence that they're beginning to use AI to, certainly for the generation of content,
right.
But at the moment, the actual posting and dissemination of the content is still quite human-based. Mm-hmm. That will not be the case for much longer. There'll be much bigger AI-driven disinformation campaigns. And I think, for me, what's most concerning about that and why this should be an area of focus for security is that we're also entering into this new world of augmented reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, seeing Apple enter a market for me is a signal that market is almost certainly going to get significantly bigger in a relatively short time frame. One of the things that I said a long time ago about Apple, which holds true today, is that Apple don't make things that people want, they make people want things.
That's so true.
Right, there was, nobody wanted tablets.
Yep.
Nobody was clamoring and demanding, saying, I want an iPad. But
they create the demand.
They created that market. They make people want things. Nobody wanted a touchscreen phone. Everybody wanted a BlackBerry.
Yeah.
People want things. And they created a market for that too. Mm-hmm. And I think, another thing that's true about Apple is that they very often don't do something first. but they do it best.
They do it best, yeah. They take their time and then they do it best.
And I think that's true about the AR world. So if you think about what does that mean going forward, well, think about the world of disinformation and artificially generated content or manipulated content in a world of AR where the internet is no longer something that you go away and consult. It's actually, for the first time in history, a technology which is overlaid on your experience of the real world, then the potential impact of disinformation in that world is exponentially greater than one where you would see it on your computer screen and then come back to real life. It's actually in between me and you. And it can change what you believe, change what you think, physically change where you go. I mean, it's an area that security needs to focus on. How do we recognize truth? How do we tell fact from fiction? How do we detect manipulated or artificially generated content? Because it will become an element, not just of disinfo, but it will become an element of attacks on businesses as well.
True, yeah.
If you want to abuse a process within an organization, then you could potentially kickstart that process abuse by making the employees of that organization believe something that is not true.
Yeah. Anything is possible with in this way, right?
If it's something that, again, is attacking the human, is attacking the way that we think or feel, and that has real implications on our actions, then the possibilities maybe are not infinite, but they are not possibilities that we have considered up until now in cybersecurity. You think about like incident response, for example, in a SOC team within an organization. Right now, you don't have to think about the psychological impact of an attack because the psychological impact is relatively small.
Right.
But if an attack involves AI-generated content in an AR-enabled world, then attacks will begin to have psychological impact as well as informational and systemic impact.
Right.
So we need to think about how we respond to that going forward. We can't afford to be on the back foot when that happens.
We need to be proactive and think about it. So is there anything that organizations can do today, kind of to be prepared for a world?
There are emerging organizations and technologies that are attempting to detect manipulated or AI-generated content. It's still very much an evolving space. Some of the bigger cybersecurity organizations are also attempting to develop technologies. It's in its infancy, though. There are definitely steps that you can take when it comes to disinformation in general within an organization. One is about empowering the people that work for you. I think it's really important that everybody within an organization has the power to say no and understands that they have the power to say no. You think about something like a business email compromise attack, right? Where someone is masquerading as the CEO. They send an email from the CEO's real inbox to someone in finance organization, says, we have this really important invoice that needs to be paid by the end of the day today. And of course, it's a fake invoice and tens of millions of dollars are taken from the business. That person sending the payment needs to not be scared of saying no to the CEO, which very often is the case, right? People don't want to say no. They want to be helpful. They want to be seen to be doing a good job. But if the process says you can't send $50 million business transfer without this particular sign-off steps, then you go to the CEO and you say, thanks for the request. We need to go through these steps first. Can we go through them, please? It's okay to say no. So you need to build that culture within the organization. And the other really important thing is pre-bunking, the concept of pre-bunking. So it's not about when disinformation arises that you have to then debunk that information to say this is not true because the huge disadvantage of that is that in order to debunk something, you have to repeat the false thing. That's a part of debunking, right? So you still amplify it. Pre-bunking is about preparing your organization, your employees, and your processes for what they might encounter, what they should be looking for, what the markers are, and what to do in response to that. So pre-bunking is far more important and more effective than debunking.
So continuous learning and training is what we can do, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You are a storyteller and a futurist. So how do you kind of take storytelling to convey the importance of cybersecurity? And is there any Hollywood kind of heists that you've seen that you can share, Hollywood style?
It's so there are no Hollywood heists. They're all much more boring than Hollywood.
Okay.
Externally, to someone who isn't in cybersecurity, they'd be like, I want to listen to that anyway. Did they get away with it or not? That's all I want to know. Get to the end of the book. Storytelling is really important, and the most important part of sharing experience, sharing knowledge in the hope of people actually learning from it, is to make it relevant to them, to make it, to put it in their context. Mm-hmm. So if that's in an enterprise scenario, it's about understanding how something affects your business, your vertical, your employees, your data, and about understanding how your environment looks compared to the environment that was targeted. So right. It's about building context and about building contact between the reality of cyber attack and the vulnerability of your business. And that's an important aspect for security tools as well. It's not just in the storytelling, it's actually in the technology. So if the technology that you deploy is not capable of contextualizing the events that are happening in your environment, making them relevant to your security organization, making them, presenting them in such a way that you can take them to the C-suite or the board and say, we need budget for these projects because these things, here's the gap analysis. If it's not capable of being contextual, it's not securing you to the best of its ability. It's the most important thing about, in security, context is king. Imagine the scenario. I was having a conversation with a guy who works for a company that makes CCTV cameras.
Okay.
So it was like more physical security. We were at an event together just having a chat. And I was thinking, if we put these kinds of technologies together, then we can build this really important context. And it's a great illustration of why context is important. Imagine there's a corridor in a building. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the corridor, there's a door that leads into a server room. Outside this door is a CCTV camera. It sees me walking along the corridor, uses facial recognition, gait recognition, whatever it might be, and says, yeah, that's Rick.
Yeah.
Rick's a cleaner. He's wearing a cleaner's uniform. This all checks out. This is good. I take my door access card, hold it up to the card reader. If these systems are connected, building context, it says, okay, that card belongs to Rick, who I've just seen in the corridor. He's a cleaner. He's allowed to come into the server room to clean the floor in the server room. I'll unlock the door. Context, right? Making the right decisions. So unlock the door opens, there's a camera on the other side of the door. The person that came through the door is still Rick. It's the same person on this side of the door. Everything checks out, this is very good. But then imagine if that camera, instead of seeing me begin to clean the floor with my mop, suddenly I pull out a keyboard from the server rack and start typing.
Right.
This is anomalous behavior. This is not something that a cleaner should be doing. Because we have context. But without context, what does that camera see? A person, unidentified, in a server room using a keyboard, suddenly it's an innocent event again. Right. So context is all important in storytelling and in the technology itself, how we implement it.
Very interesting, Rick. Thank you for that. Do you have any advice for small and medium enterprises?
So small and medium enterprises, and large ones too, actually, I think this applies to both, but it's particularly important for SMEs. Cybersecurity is very often known for being what I would call the department of no, right? No, you can't bring your own technology. No, you can't use that cloud service. No, you can't connect those two things together. Just no, because there's a risk. I like to play with words a lot. So instead of the department of no, N-O, I think it's really important to, in cybersecurity, transform that to the department of no, K-N-O-W. There are important things that you need to know, you need to understand, and this is particularly important for SMEs. You need to know your enemy, understand exactly which kinds of threats that you're going to be facing. That means keep up with the threat landscape and understand how those threats unfold. You need to know your threat model. So you need to understand, what technology do I have in my organization and in what ways can it be abused? What should I expect? If someone came in through this door, digital door, then what could they take advantage of, and how could they break it? How could they misuse it? So know your threat model. Know your risk appetite, because it's really important for spending decisions. You need to understand, how much risk am I as an organization prepared to accept? If this is super important to me and I can't have this system go down, then I need to make sure that I apply the right resources to make sure that doesn't happen. But if this one, if it goes offline for 3 days and I'm not really going to notice, I don't have to spend as much money there as I do here. I don't have to spend as much time there as I do here. It's about risk-based decision-making. So know your risk appetite. Allied to that, know your risk posture. So it's fine understanding your risk appetite, but you need to know where you are today as a business as it relates to that appetite.
How much can you take?
So yeah. Like, where do I stand now? If that's my risk appetite, is that what it looks like in my business, or do I need to change things around?
Yeah.
And then the third one that's really important, particularly for SMEs, is know your limits. Understand what you are capable of doing, understand what you do have the budget to do, and clarify what you don't know how to do or can't afford to do. Because one of the greatest tools in the box for SMEs is outsourcing.
Right.
And again, this is related to risk, right? Mm-hmm. With risk, you can do one of three things. You can mitigate the risk, spend money on it, basically. Mm-hmm. You can avoid the risk, stop doing that thing that's risky, or you can offset the risk. Offset the risk means getting insurance, or it means getting a third party to do the risky thing for you,
right,
to look after that process for you. So know your limits, and what you can't do, make sure you get the right partners to help you achieve through outsourcing or through as a service technologies.
Okay. You are like a celebrity in cybersecurity. I think
that's what people say. That's what people say, but I don't know if it's true. I tell my kids that.
What do your kids say? I think you have four, right?
Yeah, they don't believe me. I have four kids. They don't believe me at all.
Okay. Are there anyone of them into technology or cybersecurity specifically?
No. So my oldest is going to be 21 in January, and he's studying political science at university. Zero interest in technology, cybersecurity. My second oldest, she wants to work in social services for children, and she's going to be starting. She's in her final year of school this year. My third oldest doesn't know what she wants to do yet, but she has no interest in computing. And my youngest wants to be a ballerina and a vet and a singer.
So cute.
So she used to blend those things together somehow.
Okay. So I was going to say that because you're a cybersecurity celebrity, yes, you are. You need to believe it.
Okay.
You believe it. Your kids will believe it soon. There's so many things out there online, right? All so much about you. So what is the one lesser known fact about you?
A little known fact about me. This is like an Englishman's worst nightmare. You know, when you get into a meeting room and you're all sitting around the table and they say, tell us something about yourself.
Tell us about yourself.
English people go, no.
I don't want to talk about myself.
You know what? The thing is, I'm a really open person. And to some people, shockingly so, in that I don't really have anything to hide and don't feel the need to hide stuff, like talking about falling for a fishing thing. A little known thing about me, here's one. When I was probably 11 years old, I don't know if it's like this in other countries, in the late 70s, early 80s, there were all these informational films mm-hmm. aimed at kids to stop them doing stupid things. Mm-hmm. Like, don't go swimming in the gravel pit lake because you'll drown. Don't go playing on the building site because it's a really dangerous place. And so on. So of course, what that did for most of us is make us want to go and play on the building site or on the train.
Go and do it. Yeah.
So I was trying one day with just me and one friend to get to a building site. It was in a forest where they had drained the lake out so they could start building work. And we were making our way across this dried out lake bed. And there was a little stream of water still running down the middle. I jumped across the stream of water and immediately sank up to my knees in very wet, sucking mud. And like quicksand, the more you move, the lower you get. Luckily, movies on TV at the time had done things like make me irrationally afraid of quicksand that I actually have never encountered in my life, and giant ants from the jungle that were going to eat me alive. All these things you thought you were going to have to deal with at some point in life, but. So I knew that I had to somehow get flat. So I asked my friend to throw me over a big log, and I could pull myself out on the log and crawl across the mud to get back to the dry land. Went home eventually, and obviously I'm muddy up to here. I was wearing my best trousers because my grandparents were coming to visit that day. So I'd just gone off to play on a building site. I got home and I told my mum. She was like, what happened? I fell over in a puddle. She didn't actually find out the truth until I was about 37 or something, and as we were having a meal and I was telling the story. So that's a very little known story about me. I think that it relates to technology actually, because it's my innate and natural curiosity and what my wife would call my absolute inability to do as I'm told. And that has really helped me when it comes to technology. I want to know A, how things work, and B, and this is very much a hacker mindset, what happens if I press this button?
Right.
What happens if I turn this screw? Mm-hmm. What if I put the wrong number in here? What if I put too much text in here? What happens? How can I break it? How can I understand when it's broken, how to put it back together again? It means I've broken a lot of stuff, but it also means I've discovered a lot of stuff. Yeah, and it's a really important mindset for technical support, for research, for hacking, and it's that goes all the way back to innate curiosity and an inability to do what I'm told.
Do what you're told. It's got its pros and cons. Yeah. Before I let you go, one last question, Rick. With your unique vantage point on technology as well as society, do you have a personal wish or a vision for the future of our world that's becoming digital by the day?
I think the greatest challenge to humanity in general over the next decade is our ability to tell fact from fiction, reality from fantasy. That's already manifesting itself in conspiracy theories and the tribalization, polarization of society, both online and offline. Mm-hmm. You know, going through Brexit in the UK, you get to experience that it's not just online. People became tribal in their political beliefs offline as well. Families were literally torn apart, and it's not unique to the UK. It's just that was my direct experience of it. The greatest challenge is that ability to tell reality from fantasy, fact from fiction. People will dispute that and say, what about climate change, or what about deforestation, mm-hmm. or what about economic disadvantages? Well, our ability to tell fact from fiction plays into all of those things as well. People are using our inability to distinguish to advance their own agendas when it comes to climate change or medical research or redistribution of resources globally or whatever that problem might be. At the root of all of that is understanding what's real and what we need to do in response to that reality. So a great wish on that is if we could, as a community of cybersecurity professionals, researchers, practitioners, all of us, begin to consider what can we do to help establish veracity, to establish reality and truth going forwards, then it becomes much more difficult for people to maliciously repurpose facts for their own ends. I would love us as a community to begin to consider that. How do we establish truth?
That's amazing. Thank you, Rick. You've been great. I've had fun talking to you.
Thank you.
Likewise. And hope you can come back and talk to us again soon.
Yes, absolutely. It'd be fun.